It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. Well, finally, it's okay. You can admit you like your wine a little sweet and you won't get drummed out of the wine shop. Those big bruiser Chardonnays are giving way to classy, fruity little Rieslings. But we get the Riesling guide from one of the world's leading producers, Dr. Ernst Lotzen of Germany. The Sterns are into multitasking, a place in El Paso where you can eat great chicken mole while getting your car washed. Smart cook Sally Schneider turns garbage into gold, as in clever saves for so-so vinegars. Who knew simple lunch could harbor sexism and class distinctions? Well, food historian Andy Smith has the tale. And we've got a new round of Stump the Cook with celebrity stumpmaster Christopher Kimball. All this and your calls coming up on The Splendid Table. But first, this. We'll be right back. Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media and brought to you by SuperTarget. Well, today it's the modern diner's most food-friendly wine. We're talking Riesling, and we learn about what it's like on its home turf in Germany. Our guest is award-winning Riesling master, Dr. Ernst Lotzen. So the vinegar in the bottle isn't nearly as good as what was described on the bottle? Well, expert cook Sally Schneider has some great saves, and they work with super cheap supermarket vinegars, too. American food historian Andy Smith takes us back to the birth of lunch. Now, you had to be a worker or a woman, otherwise you did dinner. We have a new round of our refrigerator game, Stump the Cook, with celebrity stump master Christopher Kimball. Then a trend-tracking marketer talks what's driving our brand choices. It's called conscientious consumption. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. So let's roll with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet Magazine. Guys, I always think of you finding things that nobody would dream of finding, like, you know, the back of the grocery store, that kind of stuff. Any more finds along those lines?
Yes, indeed, Lynn. You know, Jane and I are big fans of restaurants that do something else, like restaurant and taxidermy store, or
yes,
a combination restaurant and bait shop. Well, in El Paso, Texas, we found the H&H Cafe and Car Wash. Now, this is a tiny cafe with a counter and a few tables. If you sit at the tables, you can look out the window and watch as the staff washes your car and you dine. It's a great combination.
What do you eat while you're watching your car being washed?
Mexican food.
Really zesty Mexican
Probably
food.
Probably the best huevos rancheros that I have ever had. Very, very hot. The salsa is kind of an interesting pink color, but it's kind of nitroglycerin level hot. As the waitress said when she put a dish of the salsa in front of us, mas caliente, not only muy caliente.
Well, and if you want something a little less hot, but totally chili pepper focused, the chili rellenos are just very cool, because you sit at the counter, and if you're there at the right time, which is kind of mid to late morning, you will watch them being made. I mean, each one, you know, dipped in the batter, like fried to perfection, coming out with that kind of fragile crisp crust. And these are not too hot. These are, you know, medium heat chilies stuffed
just
with cheese.
It's just such a cheerful place because they have Tejano music on the radio, and, you know, that everybody's bustling around, and, you know, virtually every man in the place is wearing a cowboy hat. And it's just a really fun, funky Southwestern experience.
And one special note should be made that if you get there on a Saturday, the special always is menudo, the tripe and hominy stew, which is famous for its power to cure a hangover. So if you drank too much Friday night, this is an excellent place to go Saturday morning.
And red chicken mole, that should not be missed. And then your car is clean also. What more could you want?
This is the kind of place that maybe you'd want to have your car washed 4 or 5 times a week.
Clean,
just,
clean car.
Just bring it through again, please.
Thanks, guys.
You're welcome.
Adios, Lynn.
Gina Michael Stern are the authors of Two for the Road. You can hear the Sterns every week right here, but you can get their food finds anytime. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. Well, it's hunting and gathering time. We have about another 15 minutes to get our hands on young basil. Now, this is pesto basil, and basil to freeze for winter. In nearly no time, it's going to throw all its innocence into producing buds, and the leaves are going to get too strong. They're going to taste like anise, and they're going to turn bitter. So gather it up, people. It's not going to be this good again until next year. Now, I've got a pesto recipe you might want to try. It's straight from what I think of as pesto heaven. This is where the sauce was invented, the city of Genoa. It's called A Classic Pesto of Genoa, and it's on the website, splendidtable.org. I like the way Sally Schneider approaches food. She's a professional cook and former chef who keeps simplifying. And she's a born improviser. Sally's author of A New Way to Cook. Hey, Sally, welcome back.
Hi, Lynn. It's great to be here.
Sally, what do you do with vinegar that is not the best? You know, I'm always buying these vinegars to taste them, and quite frankly, some of them are really disappointing, and you hate to throw them out.
I know exactly what you mean, and I have suffered from having a crowded shelf full of them for exactly the same reason. One day, Lynn, I had a eureka moment, which was really myself discovering the obvious, which is, why not take these vinegars and doctor them up? Who says I have to respect their purity because they're mediocre? Why not blend them with other vinegars or even steep them with other flavoring elements and see what happens? So the first one I tried was a Vinsanto vinegar I dragged back from Tuscany thinking it would be great, and it was always too aggressive.
Yeah, it's sweet, but it can be really tart.
It was really tart, and it just wouldn't work. And I had some tarragon lying around in the fridge, and I, you know, steeped the tarragon in the Vinsanto vinegar, and I ended up with this beautiful, brightly flavored tarragon vinegar with far more complexity than commercial versions. And somehow the tarragon was just what this unbalanced vinegar needed to make it work, and it was a revelation. Then I tried blending a slightly too rough red wine vinegar with a little bit of balsamic, which, you know, is very mellow and kind of sweet.
Right.
And some sherry vinegar, thinking it would give it some complexity and a little bit of a wood taste.
Mm-hmm.
And I had then a terrific red wine vinegar to use in salad dressings and dishes, whatever I wanted.
Right.
So this thinking opened up a vast world of possibilities. I mean, the potential marriages for vinegars and flavorings, of course, are endless. There are the obvious, which are herbs like basil and thyme and savory, aromatics like shallot and garlic, citrus zests, spices. But then imagine steeping sliced apples in a mediocre cider vinegar, or even a good cider vinegar.
That's
to up
great,
the apple
yeah,
flavor.
Bring up what's already there.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Or manipulate them a bit the way you want. My favorite flavorings are blue and red fruits. That means plums, black currants, blackberries, especially cherries, which are divine. And a trick that I tried that worked was to grind up the whole fruit and throw in the pits with it, thinking that the pits would give it something of a slightly bitter, slightly woody flavor of the wood itself. You know, like cherry pits are similar to cherry wood. I tell you, I made the grandest cherry vinegar doing this. It was quite extraordinary. And really, what you just need to keep in mind is steep the flavoring in the vinegar until it has the flavor you like, and then take it out, strain it out. There's no set amount of time. And sometimes, once you've flavored the vinegar, it'll take a little time to mellow and harmonize the flavors. So I cork it and put it on the shelf, or even leave it on the counter, and I taste it day by day or every few days until I say, ah, this is really right. And it's actually a wonderful process.
You know what I'm thinking? With all that acid, it's not going to go bad. And you can do this, you know, with almost anything, dried fruit, figs, you know, that kind of stuff too.
Exactly. And, you know, you can cook fruits like figs to go into the vinegar to extract their flavor. I've also taken cheap balsamic vinegar and cooked it with Madeira way down and added a little brown sugar and made something that is akin to, with none of the complexity, but with a great deal of delight of a long-age balsamic.
Sally, you've solved the dilemma. Thank you.
You're so welcome, Lynn.
Sally Schneider is author of A New Way to Cook, and she left us with a recipe for bitter greens with seasonal fruits and roasted nuts and her guide to upgrading vinegars. Find it on the website, splendidtable.org. There's one other thought about vinegar that came to me after talking with Sally. You can use vinegar to help keep things from spoiling and get a new flavored vinegar in the bargain. Now, here's what I mean. I love chipotle chilies in adobo. Now, these are the very hot smoked chilies that are canned in a tomato vinegar sauce. Now, even though the cans are small, you rarely use the whole thing when you open it. So you put it in a glass jar and you chill it. Now, since I'm always leery of nasty bacteria, I cover the chilies with vinegar. The acid helps preserve them. Well, that vinegar picks up all the tastes of the adobo without too much heat. So I keep spooning a little off into dressings and beans and coleslaw and over peaches and nectarines, and vanilla ice cream is next. And I'm serious. Try it. Coming up, Germany's Prince of Rieslings, Dr. Ernst Lohsen, and Status and Sexism Goes Out to Eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. Our show is brought to you by Super Target, a grocery store and Target all in one, where guests can have their cake and a plate to eat it on, too. Online at Target.com/SuperTarget. Riesling be the new Chardonnay? It certainly fits with all the foods we eat better than those big oaky bruisers. Riesling dances around spicy foods. It likes them, and it can be bright and acidic, and it tastes of fruit. And when a Riesling is very fine, it can be as profound as any wine out there. Now, although we've now got Rieslings from everywhere on earth, this wine did begin in Germany, and high on the list of fine German Riesling are the Rieslings of Dr. Ernst Lohsen. Dr. Lohsen, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you very much for the invitation.
Now, do you only make Rieslings?
Well, we do in our estate in the Mosel, the Dr. Lohsen estate, we do only Riesling, because Riesling is the traditional grape variety there and has grown since 200 years.
Now, can you give me just a quick geography lesson of where exactly we're talking about?
The Mosel is on our region, our wine-growing region along the river Mosel. Mm-hmm. It's on the very western part of Germany, just on the border of Luxembourg, France.
And Rieslings have been made there for a very, very long time, haven't they? More longer than 200 years.
Well, it was 1987 when we celebrated the 200th anniversary of Riesling in our area, because it was the Archbishop of Trier who, I mean, you know, we are a Catholic area, you know, and nearly everything belonged to the church, you know, and he decided that only Riesling has to be grown in the Mosel, and that was 1787, something like that.
now, when I read reviews of your wines, people talk about the spiciness, the boldness of the flavors, and I don't know that that's usually associated with Rieslings. I think of Rieslings often being more delicate. I mean, I guess the ultimate question is, what are your wines about? What are your goals with your wines?
Well, you know, Riesling is possibly, as no other grape variety in the world, carries so much the terroir, the area, the flavors of the soil. And therefore, you know, if we talk about Riesling from our area, from the Mosel area, where we have slate soil, our wines are rather delicate and finesse, but there are Rieslings from other areas, more south, which are grown on more heavier soils. Mm-hmm. These Rieslings can be then a little bit more forward, more bold, and more structured, you know. So from that point of view, it depends very much where the Riesling is coming from. And that's the wonderful thing with Riesling, that you find the terroir, the area where it is grown, is so wonderfully expressed in the Riesling, which nearly no other grape variety can do, like Chardonnay. I mean, Chardonnay can grow everywhere in the world and always taste the same.
So, and you make Rieslings in different parts then of the year?
Yes, exactly. We're doing a Riesling in the Mosel, in our traditional wine estate, but we have another estate at about 100 miles south of the Mosel, along the Rhine River, and here the soils are a little bit different. Here, sandy soils, you know, loamy soils, sandstone, and here the wines are rather more, I would say, a little bit more stronger,
has
vigorous,
a little
more alcohol,
muscle.
More muscle, you know, wonderful with the traditional food down there, which is a lot of pork and sauerkraut, you know. This very traditional dish there is the Saumagen, which means it's a pork stomach, which is stuffed with a lot of pork meat and potatoes, and you close it, and then you boil it, and you slice it and fry it in the pan. I tell you, it's fantastic with these wines.
What's interesting about this is you're talking about a very traditional Northern European diet that this wine works with so well. And yet I think one of the reasons it's gone through this great new rebirth in America is that we're eating so much food that is spicy, often sweet, sour. You know, we have this almost a Pacific Rim palate happening, and Riesling flies with it.
Because Riesling is pure. We don't manipulate the Riesling. We don't go through a second fermentation or malolactic fermentation, it's called too. We don't add oak to it, you know, to pump it up, you know. Mm-hmm. And this works very well with Asian food or with spicy food. I mean, this heat of the spices nearly neutralizes, you know, the sweetness of the wine. And so it becomes a wonderful, perfect balance. And then this wine has only 7.5% alcohol. Because if you have a lot of alcohol in the wine, it rather increases the heat of the spices, you know? So you have to look for a wine which is lower in alcohol. And if you have oak in the wine, oak, tannin, turns spices into bitterness, you know? And these wines like Riesling don't have oak.
You know, I think one of the barriers for Americans is German wine labels. They're so difficult to understand. Are you, with your wines, attempting to simplify it all?
Well, we did simplify it because I got the same question 10 years ago from my English importer, Ernst. Mm-hmm. German labels are so difficult to read, you know? Can't you do something for it? And so we created our estate Riesling, we call it, you know, Dr. Losen Riesling. And so we created a label which says only Dr. L.
I'm looking at a bottle of it right now.
Exactly.
And all it says is 2005 Riesling.
So here I wanted to make a showcase, you know, what wonderful Rieslings our area can produce without stressing the customer too much, you know, by reading a label. But on the other hand, we have the tradition, as in Burgundy or, I mean, all over Europe, you know, we have this very, very long tradition of single vineyard sites. And we definitely don't want to give up this tradition. So we continue to have our traditional vineyard sites on the label. But on the other hand, I tell you, it's very easy if you once got the concept of a German label. It's very easy to read a German label because it is always the same way how it is structured. It is always the vintage, okay, and the producer. For example, there is a vineyard which is called Erziger Wirtsgarten. Mm-hmm. Erzig is the village. Wirtsgarten is the vineyard. Mm-hmm. Then you have Riesling beneath it.
Right.
And then you have the Prädikat, the quality on it. And there we have in Germany different quality levels. The first quality level is Kabinett, which means it's the lightest, the earliest ripened grapes picked in the last 2 weeks of October.
Mm-hmm.
Then later picked grapes, the grapes get sweeter. That's then Spätlese, means late harvest. And then the last picked grapes are the Auslese. You see,
yes,
the highest quality is the Auslese, selected late harvest. So there is a system behind it, you know?
Well, this helps clarify a great deal.
Mm.
Dr. Lawson, thank you.
Thank you very much. Thanks.
You can find information on Dr. Lawson's Rieslings on our website, splendidtable.org. When you have too much time on your hands, like how back in 1776, Thomas Jefferson and George Washington could never have done lunch. Now, not just because Hollywood didn't exist yet to create doing lunch, but because lunch didn't exist back in 1776. According to American food historian Andrew Smith, lunch is the child of another time. Andy, it's good to have you back with us.
It's wonderful to be here, Lynn.
So Andy, why no lunch in 1776?
Well, the normal meal pattern in the 18th century was you'd have breakfast when you first got up.
Right.
Then you would have a dinner, which would normally be at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, unless you were Frenchified, in which case it would be a little later.
Uh-huh.
Then supper would be in the late evenings, and it would usually consist of soup or leftovers from dinner. And that was the pattern that people followed.
So when did lunch start?
Lunch is really a creation of the 19th century and the industrialization of America, when you had whistles blowing and people supposed to eat at the time that the whistles blow, and they had a very short period of time, frequently 10 or 15 minutes, and sometimes people weren't even paid for their lunch.
Really?
So it's a real 19th century invention that starts off with industrialization.
Where did the word come from?
Well, the word lunch itself goes back to the 16th century, and it means hunk of. So,
hunk of?
Yes. But the word itself transformed itself in America. And lunch as we know it today is really an Americanism. And it's a real late 19th century creation.
Was it a class thing? I mean, the factory worker versus the wealthy?
Yeah, because the wealthy would have continued to have dinner all the way up to the mid 20th century,
mm-hmm.
and that would have been the creation of the three martini lunches. What was in many ways a continuation of the upper class lunch.
You know what I'm remembering? Something about bar food, that it used to be you could go into a bar and for the price of a beer there would be almost like a buffet.
Yeah, well, there's different types of lunch, and for the lower class, the lunch was bar food, of which case the food was free, and you just paid your bar bill, and they have great descriptions in the late 19th century of people walking into a bar and eating tons of food and having three or four drinks, and 10 minutes later, they're gone.
Yeah.
So it's a very short thing. Now, on the other hand, lunch was also an upper-class women's activity, too, so it's not just male, it's not just lower-class, upper class, it's also male and female. And females would have lunch in the clubs that emerged after the American Civil War, created many of the sandwiches, for instance, that we think of as common today, the club sandwich being an example of it. But they would not have been large and thick. They would have been small and dainty.
So were there actually, was this the beginning of what we think of as lunch food? I know the sandwich existed for a long time, but it's so associated with lunch and sort of little salads and things like that. Was it these women's lunch clubs that started all of that?
Yeah, the dainty lunches are a genuine invention of the women's clubs of the late 19th century, early 20th century. And the sandwiches in this case would be an inch square so that you could consume it straight without having to take a bite out of it and setting it down, which would have been considered inappropriate at the time. So they would be very small, and the salads that we think of today, many of the salads were invented in the late 19th century, early 20th century, and the intent was to eat them for lunch. So you could have a light lunch and still have your large dinner now would be in the evening, so you would not really want to eat a lot at lunch.
Yeah, I'm just thinking, because it's been said that lunch is dead, that people aren't taking time for lunch. Do you think it's going to make a comeback?
Well, I think meals are dead. People snack all day long, and the breakfast is not what we used to think of it as, the English breakfast with eggs and bacon and all the rest of the accoutrements. It's really something small, and lunch is small, and frequently dinner is not what it once was, the family getting together and having a large meal. So people tend to graze all day, at least in cities, and it tends not to a real breakdown of the meal pattern that have existed for hundreds of years.
So we just have one buffet going all day.
Well, that sounds good. Wait a minute. Let's not reject this.
if the food's good. Hey, Andy, thank you.
Thank you, Lynn.
American food historian Andrew Smith is editor-in-chief of the Oxford Encyclopedia of Food and Drink in America. Now, inspired by those first lunches, I've got a recipe for you. It's called Old Time Bar Lunch Sandwich. Find it on the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, sign up for our weekly e-newsletter. Every week we send you a quick worknight recipe. The goal is to make your worknight suppers a bit easier. And best of all, weeknight kitchens, free. So sign up, splendidtable.org. It's time to play Stump the Cook, our refrigerator game, with our guest celebrity stump master, Christopher Kimball of Cook's Illustrated Magazine and host of PBS's America's Test Kitchen. Chris, are you ready to play?
Lynn, I'm ready to play.
Okay, can you lay out the rules for everybody?
Yeah, there are three simple rules. There are five things that our guest will tell you about from his or her refrigerator. You get a free pass on water, salt, and pepper, and some sort of oil. And plus, you can use three other ingredients that are, in fact, in our guest kitchen.
Okay, and then I have to come up with a dish that you and the guest would actually want to make.
Yeah, edibility would be, of course, yes, that would be good. We got to want to eat it, right. I forgot to mention that. Well, we have Scott from High Point, North Carolina. Hi, Scott. How are you?
Hi, Chris. Hi, Lynn.
What's in the fridge? What do you got?
Well, I've got a kielbasa. I have spaghetti squash. Uh-huh. I have some goat chèvre.
Mm-hmm.
I have some pine nuts.
Great.
And I have a bag of frozen blueberries.
Hey.
Good.
Always
80%, you were doing well.
I love blueberry stuff.
I love blueberries too.
For dessert. We're not making a sauce, are we?
No. Well, let me see now. Okay, so we've got five things. We've got the kielbasa. Is the kielbasa already cooked?
Yes, it is.
Okay. Spaghetti squash, pine nuts, goat cheese, and frozen blueberries.
Is this guy a gourmet or what?
I love it. Only people who listen to The Splendid Table. I mean, this is great. Okay. The first thing that we're going to do is we're going to bake the spaghetti squash, okay, because we want to get the spaghetti out of it. In the meantime, now I get salt, pepper, water, and some form of oil. How about garlic? How do we stand on garlic?
I've got garlic.
You've got garlic. Okay.
I wouldn't make this without garlic.
I understand. And, yeah, I get you. Okay. Big skillet. We need big skillet. Do you have olive oil in the house?
Oh, absolutely.
All right. Good. Yeah, of course. You're our kind of listener, of course. We're gonna fill in the bottom of the pan with the olive oil. All right. We're going to chop up about 3 or 4 cloves of garlic. And I think I only have three ingredients. I've got to really think this one out.
This is the kind of guy who's got lemongrass, you know. I mean,
I don't have lemongrass.
Don't.
Do you have a little bit of cream?
Oh, yeah, I have cream.
All right, so I'm going to use garlic, cream, and I'm going to use onion.
Okay.
So you're going to chop up the onion. You're going to film the skillet with the oil. You're going to saute the onion until it's really nice and brown. Stir in 3 or 4 cloves of garlic that you've, you know, smashed and minced.
Right.
Okay. And then what you're going to do is you will have cut up kielbasa with that onion, by the way.
Okay.
So that the onion is now flavored. The garlic goes in. And then what I want to do is have you add cream, about a half a cup of cream.
And the spaghetti squash, the other thing you would have done, by the way, is toasted the pine nuts. You just would have put them in the oven with the baking spaghetti squash. And what you're going to do is toss that spaghetti squash with the kielbasa and the onion and whatever all together. And then you're going to turn that into a platter, to a nice, shallow, big bowl. You're going to scatter it with pine nuts, dot it with that goat cheese.
No, don't tell me the blueberries are coming.
Yes, they are.
Oh,
but
no.
There's only 10 of them. And the 10 of them will be scattered about because the sweet sort of acidity of the blueberry against the creaminess of the cream and the cheese and the spiciness of the kielbasa and the browning of the onion and the neutrality of the spaghetti squash will give us a pretty reasonable, very pretty dish because the squash is golden and we've got all of this lovely sort of, you know, taupe and brown and buff color and whatever, and then the white cheese and the white cream and the golden pine nuts. I think this could be a winner.
I noticed you didn't mention the color of the blueberry.
I think a little dot here and there of aubergine is a really lovely idea.
I don't know, Lynn. I think I like a little bit more blueberry in this thing.
Scott, you're going to destroy my reputation.
I have a better idea. Leave the blueberries for dessert with some heavy cream. Just get them out of the squash.
All right, but then I'm not using all five ingredients.
I know.
Okay.
Lynn, I'm going to give you a free pass on the blueberries, which are the bane of all of these tests. So everything else sounded fabulous. And you are a winner.
I win! Yes! You could puree the blueberries with a little bit of whipped cream, and it would be a nice sort of, you know, creamy dessert.
Dessert, yeah, that's right.
I will have them as dessert with a little cream on them, like Chris suggested.
Hey, Scott, thanks for playing.
This was fun. Thanks for having me.
And Chris, you're being extremely tolerant today.
I'm in a good mood today. You got
a
free pass.
Very touched.
Great job.
Thank you, sir. Our guest celebrity stump master is Christopher Kimball, editor and publisher of Cook's Illustrated magazine and host of PBS's America's Test Kitchen. Now, if you want to challenge me in Stump the Cook, you have two options. Call us at 800-537-5252. One of our canny producers may call you to be on the air, or get in touch with us at Food Talk, our gather group. You'll find it at splendidtable.org. Well, it's time for this week's trivia challenge. Now, here's the question. Where did bib lettuce get its name? Now, we're going to have that answer in a moment, and we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Super Target. It's Target, now available in food, where you can find the expected and unexpected aisle after aisle, online at target.com/supertarget. Now, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls in a moment. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, Where did bib lettuce get its name? Well, the answer is from Senator John Bibb, who first grew the lettuce in Kentucky in the mid-1800s. He was an amateur horticulturalist who lived in Frankfort, Kentucky. Now, the key to bib is the fact that Kentucky's soil is especially alkaline because of its limestone content, and it gave the lettuce a sweetness. The other name for bib lettuce is Kentucky limestone. Now, my few tastes of it have been like eating the steak of lettuces. The leaves are actually juicy. And I have a real estate note. I came across a notice on the Kentucky Trust for Historic Preservation site. John Bibb's Gothic Revival, 6-bedroom, 7,000-square-foot house is for sale for a mere $600,000. The house is fine, but imagine what you might find in the garden.
If you're feeling sad and lonely, there's a service I can render. Tell the one who loves you only, I can be so warm and tender. Call me, don't be afraid, you can call me. Late, but you call me, tell me, and I'll be around.
It's time for your calls, brought to you by Hefty One Zip Bags. Pick up that phone. The number is 800-537-5252. Okay, let's see. Who is up? We have got Martha calling from Gaston, Oregon. Martha, what do you want to talk about?
Well, my husband went visiting some friends up on Hood Canal in Washington.
Right.
And came back with gooey duck.
Oh, the clam.
Yes.
The clam on steroids. These are clams, guys, that can be, what, 3 to 5 pounds?
Oh, easily.
And they've got that long, long, long foot. It can stretch out to a couple of feet.
They have a long foot and they have a long siphon.
Yeah, I'm thinking of the siphon. I'm just thinking, yeah, yeah. And then, so now what's the question?
Well, the question is, how is the best way to cook it? What I've done with the one was basically I've taken my little meat hammer and pounded it flat.
Right.
And then cut it in thin strips and breaded it with a panko mix seasoned with garlic, salt, and pepper, and parsley, and dill. And
there is nothing wrong with this, Martha. This sounds absolutely fabulous.
But is there another, and then just sauteed it very lightly in olive oil.
That's great.
What else can I do with it?
Oh, boy. No, you know what? When you're thinking gooey duck, think squid.
Right.
Anything that you can do with squid, you can do with gooey duck, and it has the same quality as squid. You either cook it, and you're doing exactly the right thing. Thin slices, you get that skin off that long siphon, which
right.
is like a long leg almost. And as you said, and you've got some of the body meat, but the key is, as you know, thin slices on the diagonal or pound it. One thing that some people do, and it's very simple, and it's sort of a Chinese approach to it, is have a broth that's flavored with ginger and garlic and perhaps has, a little bit of scallion in it.
Okay.
Simmering, and just have that in the middle of the table over a little burner and have very thin slices of the gooey duck, and everybody just dips the gooey duck in and out. Like squid, you either cook gooey duck for seconds or mm-hmm. you cook it for a very long time, like 45 minutes, to have it very tender and melting. But then you would have a dipping sauce at everybody's place, and the dipping sauce would be soy sauce and rice wine vinegar and sugar and a bit of chili, and you would have that and a bit of sesame oil. And you would dip that just barely cooked thin, thin sliver of gooey duck in that.
Right, and it's such a delicate flavor. That's the thing that we found is that, oh, my God, I mean, it is like the best calamari I've ever had.
Exactly. Unbelievable. And another thing that you can do, of course, is do chowder, which is cut the whole thing up and cook it and cook it and cook it and cook it. But you can keep it pretty delicate with just a little garlic, a little onion, maybe some fresh herbs.
and just let it make its own broth. And you know, cook that until the meat is extremely tender, and then at the last minute, maybe put in some really nice thin slivers so that as it goes to the table, you just drop in the raw stuff so you get that incredible, fresh, sweet, tender quality. You get
right.
two dimensions. So it's like a soup, a little broth of gooey duck.
Oh, fabulous. I'm having it for dinner tonight.
Oh, boy. You know, now that I think, that's a pretty brilliant idea. Hey, enjoy. Enjoy.
Thank you, Lynn.
You take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye. In case you have never had gooey duck, it is this huge clam with a long, long foot. It buries itself in the sand by actually digging down with that long foot, which extends, and pulling itself into the sand. And if you drive along the coast in Oregon or Washington State, you'll see people on their bellies on the beach, digging furiously, trying to dig down to grab the gooey duck. I've heard that you can only take one a day, but one of them, since they range between 3 and 5 pounds, will feed quite a few people. And it's just a wonderful delicacy. If you're in the Pike Place Market in Seattle, you'll see them. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Okay, who's up next? We have got Julia calling from St. Paul. Julia, what do you want to talk about?
Raspberries.
Oh, yeah. Okay. What do you want to talk about raspberries?
Well, I have fresh raspberries, and I'm looking to make a dessert.
Ooh.
Possibly with chocolate, but not necessarily, and preferably that children would like to eat, but again, not necessarily. We're having guests come to dinner.
How much have you got of them?
I think I have about a quart.
Got a quart. Well, I mean, one of the purest things, and granted, it's not anything new, but one of the purest things you can do is a raspberry tart.
Okay.
You know, a sugar cookie crust, which you'll find anywhere. It's a, you know, it may be called in French a pâte sucrée. It's a sweet pie dough.
Okay.
And sometimes it has so much butter in it and so much sugar, you just pat it into a shallow tart pan because you can't roll it out.
Okay.
And you pre-bake that.
Okay.
And then what you do is you can take just simply whipped cream, or you can take really fresh ricotta cheese and puree it and fold whipped cream into it. Sweeten it to taste. And you spread a thin, you know, like a half inch of that over the bottom of the crust.
Okay.
And then what you do is you can take half of your raspberries and cook them down with sugar until they're almost like a jam.
Okay.
And spread that over the chill. By the way, you just keep chilling this, you know, as you put it in the fridge. And then at the last minute, put the fresh raspberries on top that you've lightly sugared.
Okay.
And that way you get two dimensions. That's one thing you can do. Another thing you could do is, with 4 cups of raspberries, you can make a frozen Italian semifreddo. This is like a cross between an ice cream and a mousse.
Oh, that sounds good.
And you puree them in a food processor with a whole vanilla bean.
Okay.
And a little bit of salt. And what you do is you puree them until they're just broken down to almost nothing. And then you force that through a sieve. So you want to get rid of the seeds and any leavings from the vanilla bean. And this is a little more complicated, but this you can do ahead. Okay.
Okay. Okay.
If for a quart, you would have a cup of whipping cream, you know, not whipping cream, a heavy cream that you've whipped and set in the fridge.
Okay.
And then you're going to make something called an Italian meringue. Now, this sounds complicated, but once you nail this, this can become like a foundation recipe for different fruit.
Okay.
Italian meringue is meringue that you pour, as the egg whites are beating, you pour hot sugar syrup into it. And what happens is you cook the egg whites so they're safe to eat, and you stabilize them. So they become almost like very soft marshmallows, and they don't ever, you know, deflate. And you can freeze that, and it becomes like an ice cream. So this is how you make it. You need a freestanding mixer. Do you have one?
Yep.
Oh, great. Okay.
Yeah.
4 egg whites in the largest bowl that goes with the mixer.
Okay.
Okay. A pinch of salt in there. And then you want 1 cup of sugar in a very tiny saucepan, and you're going to need a deep fat and frying and candy thermometer. It's one of those things you can stick in that has a mercury-like liquid that goes up a thermometer so you can see a scale going up to about 250 degrees.
Oh, okay.
And every kitchen shop has one of these deals.
Okay.
Taylor makes
good.
Them, and you'll keep them forever. I've had mine 20 years. It'll last forever. And so the idea is you want to put a cup of sugar and about a quarter cup of water in that saucepan.
Okay.
And you want to stick the candy thermometer in it, and you want to start it boiling, and you want to bring it up to about 240 degrees.
Okay.
And at 240 degrees, turn on the mixer with the big whip attachment, okay?
Right.
And start beating those egg whites at medium speed a few seconds and then get them up to high. Keep boiling the sugar. And when the sugar gets to 248 to 250 degrees, and this is where you have to act fast.
Okay.
Whip that thermometer out of the pan. Use a towel or a pad that you don't want to burn yourself.
Okay.
And don't have the kids around for this.
Yeah.
Okay, because this is hot sugar syrup. You're going to, with the egg whites beating, you're going to pour this along, because the egg whites should at that point be in soft peaks. It happens very fast. You pour this down the side of the mixer, and it's just keep beating. Just don't touch it. Don't look at it. Keep beating like crazy. Beat about 5 minutes. Lower the beating to about a medium, and keep beating until it's at room temperature, which will be about another 4 or 5 minutes.
Oh, okay.
Now you're going to have, like, soft marshmallows. And they're going to be fabulous tasting. I mean, it's just this. I love egg whites. I just think egg whites are great. Now you're going to fold the puree and the cream and the whatever together, and you're going to put it in a pretty bowl, and you're going to freeze it. And 3 hours before you serve it, and that can keep for a month. 3 hours before you're going to serve it, you put it in the refrigerator, and it softens up ever so slightly. And you you could put it in bowls. You could put it in wine glasses. You could layer it with extra raspberries in wine glasses. You see what I'm saying? And imagine what that's going to be like when nectarines and peaches.
Beautiful.
Yeah. And you can mix fruits, you know. But it's a basic formula. You just have 4 egg whites, cup of sugar, cup of cream, 4 to 5, even 6 cups of fruit that you puree.
Okay. Wonderful.
Okay.
Well, this will make a great dinner for us.
You've now got 3 ideas. You're going to need more raspberries.
Great. Yeah.
Okay. Hey, Julia, thanks for calling.
Thanks so much.
You take care.
Okay. You too. Bye-bye.
Bye. Could it be that the good guys are winning after all? It seems that our motivations for buying one brand over another have become more charitable. Now, Larry Wu has made a living tracking why we choose one brand over another. He's vice president and consumer strategist for food and beverages at Iconoculture. Hey, Larry, welcome.
Hey, thank you, Liz.
So, Larry, in your consumer strategizing, what's pushing our choices?
Well, we have to kind of look at it from a historical perspective first, just to kind of ground everyone in what drives consumer purchasing behavior. I think early on, say in the 30s and 40s, consumers were really looking for what we call product attributes or performance. So the example I like to use is in laundry detergents. And consumers were looking for the detergent that made their whites whiter and their colors brighter. And really, companies back then tried not to put their company name or their brands out there for consumers, because for some reason they thought the biggest deal was whether their products performed or not. Later on, as I think as marketing became kind of like a career choice and an opportunity for business people, consumers started equating brand names with product performance. So then we understood that Cheer was the best detergent for cold water temperatures. And if I mention Whisk to consumers, they know what? Ring around the collar, right? So you start, you are able to start differentiating your product around specific attributes of performance.
Right.
And then create this brand loyalty around it. Okay. So what we're finding new now is there's a third way of differentiating your brand and your product. And it has nothing to do with the product or the performance of that product. So the example I use is bottled water. How do you start differentiating different brands of bottled water? And I think now there's upwards of, say, 1,800 brands of bottled water. And I've heard brands try to make a point of difference like wetter water and, you know, things like that. And it's very difficult to say how one water bottled water is different from another. So we're starting to see brands make connections that are very conscientious in how they're approaching it. So they're starting to align themselves, say, with a third-party charity. For example, Ethos Water, where a nickel of that purchase goes to find water for third world or developing areas of the world that don't have access to clean drinking water. And they're, again, making a connection to something that tugs at your consciousness or your the ethical part of you that says, okay, how can I make the world a better place? And it's a great way now of differentiating brands.
You know, I'm curious, what do you think is the place of Walmart in all of this and their statement that they're going to be deeply committed to carrying organic foods? Is that falling under this banner of conscientious consumerism?
Yeah, I think a mass marketer like Walmart or even Safeway that's starting to make this move is really, again, they're touching on something that consumers are starting to show in their purchasing behavior. Companies like White Wave, soy products, they're claiming that they're going to use wind power for all their production facilities. So things like that really give consumers a story behind the company and the brand.
Yeah, it's interesting because I'm thinking also about the criticism of Walmart that they're encouraging large industrialization of organics. Do you think that's also kind of influencing things too?
Yeah, I think there might be a backlash to organic. I think the reason large companies are doing it might be less than altruistic. Maybe they're looking at it as a way of getting a little higher profit margin, and they're finding that it's a good label claim to put on your product. And consumers are starting to ask not only, is it organic, but, man, how much fossil fuels are you using to ship those organic products around the country?
So maybe this conscientious consumerism is going to be a lot more challenging to industry.
Definitely.
I think the future is going to be really interesting to track for people like you, isn't it?
It really is, yeah. Uh-huh. And that's kind of what makes it exciting and fun.
Hey, we'll check back.
Okay, thank you so much.
Hey, Larry, thank you.
You're welcome.
Larry Wu is Vice President and Consumer Strategist for Iconoculture. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. Remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. And until next week, let me leave you with this thought from Fran Lebowitz. She said, even when freshly washed and relieved of all obvious confections, children tend to be sticky. Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media and brought to you by SuperTarget. Everything you heard here today and so much more can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, be sure to sign up for our weekly e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. It's our attempt to simplify your kitchen life midweek. So register for it online, splendidtable.org. The Splendid Table is brought to you in part by Hefty, maker of the Hefty OneZip, a food storage bag designed to close the first time, every time. And by the way, you can now take us with you. Simply download our weekly podcast, Kitchen Questions. Check the site for details. Our producers are Sally Swift and Jennifer Russell. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Judy Graham and Jeff Harkness. Have a great week. Be sure to join us next time. And thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.